Can I start, Mr. Holdsworth, by asking you a bit about your background?
Yep.
When were you born and whereabouts?
July 21st, 1929, born in Duckingfield.
Where's that?
It's in Tameside. It's one of the five towns that comprise latter-day Tameside in Lancashire.
And what did your parents do?
My father was an iron moulder, iron and brass moulder, and my mother was a tailoress.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had one brother, Donald, who was 2 years younger than me.
And were your family political at all?
No, my father was a trade unionist, voted Labour, but that was it, you know.
Did they talk about politics?
No. In fact, never heard any politics from them at all, apart from, you heard that later on, he was sacked at one factory for being seen with the Daily Herald in his pocket, you know, but I mean, that was just the employers during their dotty period. But he never even discussed trade unionism with me, you know.
Did they have any other influences on you, your parents, religious? Or?
They were very religious. They didn't really have any impact on me at all. In my early youth, I'd been away in a convalescent home from the age of 5 to 7. And at the time, we came under Cheshire, because I lived in Duckingfield, and you had to pay to be in hospital then, children, and I was at the West Kirby Convalescent Home. You were only allowed to see, the parents were only allowed to see the child once a month. They could go on a Sunday once a month. So I only saw them 24 times in 2 years, and so they abandoned me afresh, you know. And it was hardship for them because they were having to pay it on the panel. But of course, they moved house during the time. My grandfather found a deposit for a house for them because they were told by the doctors they'd have to move because of my health. I was always getting double pneumonia and so on. So we went into Lancashire and they paid. Lancashire paid. It was only Cheshire that didn't pay for children. So it became free then, the last year of the convalescent home, so it wasn't too bad for them. But as a consequence, I was never really close to my parents. I mean, my brother had completely supplanted me by the time I'd come out. And my mother didn't help it. So I never felt close to them. In fact, quite antagonistic to my mother, you know.
What about education? What kind of school did you go to?
Well, I'd missed the first couple of years at school. So I finished up in a secondary modern. It was before the 1944 Education Act, of course, which set up the secondary moderns, but it was a trial one. They were trying them in Ashton. They had a technical school, Ashton Technical School, and the Higginbottom Modern School, which were in the same building, and they were like, it was like a prototype for the 44 Act. And I was at the modern school. I took a scholarship at the end of it, because we left at 14 then, and for another year, they give you a 50 quid grant, the local authority. And it was co-educational, the fourth form, this extra year. But I only did 6 months, because I just wasn't really interested in the thing. And I left school 14 and a half. My parents had to pay this 50 quid back, apparently.
Because you left?
Because I left. It was a Higginbottom scholarship, you see. And they weren't very pleased. And I went in as a baker's apprentice, for 6 months. Then he was only paying me £1 a week. And I wanted more money, he wouldn't give it, so I left and went in engineering, doing war work.
How do you describe your education? Was it a sort of technical type of education? Was it like a sort of technical school? Or?
No, it was just the basics.
But you didn't enjoy being at school?
It was okay. It was quite a good school. Certainly the teachers were quite good. Yeah, it was okay. I wasn't against it. It was just that I didn't see any purpose in the thing. I wanted to join the Navy, really. I was in the Sea Cadets. And
how long were you in the cadets?
A couple of years.
And you enjoyed that, did you?
Yeah, I was into rifle shooting, and I'd entered for the All England Championship for the Sea Cadets. We were shooting it out at Richmond-on-Thames during the Doodlebug raids. We were on HMS Discovery, Scott's ship on the Thames. We were billeted on that. And so with Doodlebugs coming over all the night, so the guy that won it was from Kingston-on-Thames. Not surprisingly. But I came fourth. And
how many people were?
About 16, something like that.
And you had to go through qualifying?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So you say you like this, the idea of the Navy. Were you, at the time, given that you were in the cadets during the war, were you seeing the Navy in terms of fighting, or was it just an adventure?
It was like an adventure. It was to get away from home and see a bit of the world, you know, and get away from Ashton. I mean, it was...
What was it like in Ashton at the time?
Well, there was nothing there, really. I mean, cinemas and the Pallady dance. But, I mean, there was nothing really. There was a church youth club and that we used to go to. But, I mean, there was nothing there really. It just seemed a big bore to me. I wanted something different. And a bit more, you know, life. I certainly didn't want to be stuck in Ashton all my life, so...
But as it was, you joined... Left school and became a
banker's assistant. Yeah. Well, of course, you couldn't join until you were 15 and a half, you see.
So were you at the time doing that, consciously filling in time before you applied to join the Navy?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes. Yeah.
And how long were you with the banker's?
6 months, and then 6 months at Turner's, the engineering firm. Yeah.
What were you doing there?
Centre Lathe Turner. And... then I got accepted.
For the Navy.
For the Navy, joined in 44.
Yeah, can I ask you about that? First of all, why did you join the Royal Navy as opposed to the Merchant Navy? Because I'm told that the pay was better in the Merchant Navy.
I never thought about the Merchant Navy. And we've been in the Sea Cadets. You're oriented to the Royal Navy, sort of thing.
Did the Royal Navy appear a bit more glamorous and exciting?
Well, I don't know. I never thought about the Merchant Navy. It never entered my head.
Did you expect, what date was that? Was the war still
on? Yes, it was February 1944. So you'd like another year in the war.
So did you expect when you joined at some point to see active service yourself?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And that didn't...
No. I mean, it wasn't real active service. I mean, you had no conception of what it'd be like.
Presumably, people older than you would have done, so what was the reaction of your family to this?
Well, they didn't want me to go in, although I don't suppose they were too bothered. My father had always said, well, his father had let him do what he wanted. I mean, he made this, stupid decision to be a moulder, iron and brass moulder, above all things, you know, one of the worst jobs in industry. Because he liked moulding, actually. But they were poorly paid all during the war, and so he always said, well, my father let me pick what he wanted to be. His brother was a draftsman, you know, always on good money and a soft job. And so you choose your own thing, you see. And so he didn't object, and he was very chauvinist as well, you know, British chauvinism and so on, so no doubt he supported it. He wanted to join up, but of course he was essential trades. In fact, he'd been working at this Planet Foundry.
He'd wanted to join up at the beginning of the war, was this?
Yeah. And at the beginning of the war, he'd left the Planet Foundry, where did rotten wages and rotten conditions, and got a job at Mather & Platt's, a really good job, engineer storekeeper. Come out in moulding, and white collar jobs had her, and he was very happy. The war was declared, and under the Essential Trades Act, he was drafted back to the planet. Which was a wage reduction and everything, and he's back to this rotten job again. And of course, he was essential trades, they wouldn't let him join up.
Why had he wanted to join?
Well, it was British chauvinism.
What do you mean by that?
That he was patriotic.
And do you think that was normal?
Yeah, it was then.
You don't think people would have been grateful to be in a reserved job?
Oh, there were some, yes. There's quite a few didn't want to join up. Aye, did you? A lot were glad they were in reserve trade, because they made the money during the war. But, I mean, it wasn't all that good. Because they had to do the work and then do fire watching, protecting the factories when they worked out. And you were expected to do a volunteer job as well, like you was in the auxiliary fire brigade. You know. So they were, it was like full time.
But there were no objections to you joining,
then? No, no.
Right. So how did you go about joining?
I went to the recruiting office in, what's it called, in Manchester. The square the town hall is on. I can't think of the name of it.
Is that St Peter's?
No, it's behind St Peter's. And we went to the recruiting office and signed up there, and they gave you a shilling. That was the King's shilling sort of thing. And that was your first week's wage. And then was drafted to HMS St George in Douglas the Alamo.
Sorry, if I can just go back a moment. What form did the interview take? Did you just walk in the office and that was it? Or?
No, you filled in a bit of an exam form and so on, and they questioned you about your education and what have you. And then I signed on, which was 12 years from the age of 18. So I was 15 and a half, so it was like 14 and a half years.
So for someone that young, I mean, today that sounds quite surprising.
You had to get your parents' permission, of course. You know, they had to sign that they agreed.
And did you have any get-out clause so that when you were 18...
No.
So at 15, that was you were it. Effectively.
You signed up for 14 and a half years till 30. Yeah, you were in till you were 30.
So where did you, once you joined, where did you do your training?
We went originally to St George, which was the old Cunningham's holiday camp on the Douglas the Isle of Man. And we were there till the end of the war with Germany. And then they moved us from Cunningham Holiday Camp to Shotley, Ganges, HMS Ganges at Shotley, near Harwich.
So that was, you did your training on land and then training on a ship?
No, it wasn't a ship. They were both land establishments.
Oh,
Ganges was the famous and notorious boys training thing for the sea. With the famous Foudroyant's mast there that you had to climb up every morning, you know. It was, and of course, with the war having ended with Germany, they were starting a new regime, so it was a lot tougher at Ganges. I mean, right from the start, they were trying to, they were tattling us about smoking. It had never been a problem at St. George. But now we were forbidden to smoke parts of the day. And then it was talking about not being allowed to smoke at all. And the regime was tightening up all the...
Was that just at Ganges, or was that happening everywhere? Just happened.
Well, we don't know. I don't know. I mean, that was our experience at Ganges, that it was tightening up.
So why was that? Why were they tightening up?
Well, we'd heard one of the rumours was that... they'd be pensioning off some of the officers, going on half pay, you know, as surplus to the requirements of the Navy. And so they were presumably toughening up to show that they, you know, were needed and all that, you know. They were showing keen sort of. But I think there was also this thing that they felt that during the war it had been a lot more slap happy because they got used to dealing with hostilities only people. You know, the regime had become a bit soft. So they were getting back to the old pre-war regime of tight discipline and all that. And it all came to a head where we had this. We're all lined up on the parade ground, all the ship's company. And they had the third Sea Lord came down to speak to us. And he just... we were flabbergasted. It was like a big attack on us. And how they were going to really, you know, tighten up on us and we'd get some real discipline and so on. And it was the first spontaneous action I'd seen of a crowd. All these young lads, because we're all about 15 and a half, 16, it was like a big roar of anger came from them. You were like caught up in it. And you could see its impact on the officers and on the Third Sea Lord. And the meeting was brought to an end. You know, the parade was brought to an end. And there was a big shaking up. They got rid of the captain and a few of the officers. And they brought in Captain Bell of the Cossack. You know, the one that had rescued the Altmark, the prisoners on the Altmark in the Norway campaign. And
so he was seen as a bit of a hero, was he?
Oh, yes, he was. Probably one of the best. Of course, the press had made a lot of it. When they captured this German ship, the Altmark, all the British prisoners, Merchant Navy mainly, were in the hold. You know, they got them all in the hold. And this guy came in and, the Cossacks here, this is what he said to them, you know, and that was the big headline in all the papers. We used to get the Daily Dispatch, that was it. And... oh, I did made a big thing of it. So, Captain Bell, you know, got quite a name. This daring act of the
Cossack. The very fact that this man was being sent
made you think that it was a prestige thing.
Something was going on.
They were dismayed at this reaction from the lads, you know, from the boys even. They'd sort of, they weren't prepared for it. Oh, we weren't prepared for it. I was completely I mean, he shook us up as much as anybody.
But apart from this display of disgruntlement, it didn't go any further than that. It wasn't, or was it just the fear of insubordination, do you think, that frightened them?
No, they weren't frightened. I mean, that was what it was a demonstration of, that they weren't frightened of him, you know. And they weren't prepared to put up with all this bullshit.
I meant that frightened the officers.
It frightened the officers because we were only kids to them. Now, seriously, we were 15 and a half, 16. And to get them, it must have been, you know, fairly frightening to see all this, a big mass crowd, hundreds and hundreds of them all sort of roaring anger at the thing. I mean, it was something they wouldn't expect.
To go back to the start of your training at St George, did you like it? When you first joined the Navy, you were sent to this place. What did you think of it?
The first impressions there, after about a fortnight, I felt I'd made the wrong decision. You know, I didn't want to be in, because it was a bit too late. I mean, it was the discipline that you had. They cut all your hair off. You had this ill-fitting suit. You were... I was one of the backward swimmers, those that couldn't swim. They called you backward swimmer. You know, it was a psychological thing, being backward. And they sort of really tormented you until you passed your basic swimming thing. They used to have us... We had to swim naked. And they had these physical training officers that used to take it, you know, making fun of you. I was particularly thin. So we poor... You know, a fairly poor family, and making fun of your genitals as well. You know, we're all sort of it was like hell. So you were really under pressure to learn to swim fairly quick. You know.
So you're saying they were trying to humiliate you, really?
Yeah, to get you through, so you know you'd work at it.
And did they make you swim? Did they physically force you to swim? What would they do?
They had this long pole, And if you put your feet on the bottom, they used to hit you on the head with the pole, you know. It's funny looking back on it, but it was like misery, you know, when it was happening. But we all passed. I mean, the thing is, the system worked. There's no doubt about it. It worked fairly rapidly because you were really determined to learn how to swim.
What kind of people had enlisted with you? Did you join with anyone you knew?
Yes, I joined with my pal that was in the Sea Cadets and in the Congregational Church with us. Noel Green lived in Duckingfield. And we palled it together. Used to go out together, us and two other lads, but they didn't join. So we joined together. But I went into the seaman branch and he went into a radio telegraphist branch.
Why was that?
He fancied it, you know.
So you didn't join particularly to stick together, you just both decided
yeah,
to join?
Yeah, well, he wanted to be one, I didn't particularly. He'd done Morse code, he knew Morse code and so he went to that. I mean, it was, I wish I'd have gone to that, it was a better job, you know, telegraphist. So when we got to St. George, we were separated. And we didn't see all that much of each other after that. And then after we left St. George, I never saw him again. Never, you know, in all the rest of the years.
So what were the people who you'd come into the Navy with like? Were they from your region or were they from all over?
No, they were from all over. Scotland, Liverpool, Birmingham, Coventry, Oxford. There's a couple from Manchester. But they were spread from all over the country.
Did you find that, you say you'd lived your life in Ashford and you were quite keen to get out of the...
Yeah.
Presumably it's, you know, a small place and you wanted to break out of it a bit. Did you find that these other kids had a similar sort of life to you, or what sort of background did they have?
I don't know. We never went into anything like that. You never talked about your personal life to people. I certainly didn't, you know. And you never really knew what the personal background was of your friend. You took them as they were, you know.
But you got the impression, did you, that they were sort of similar? No, nobody seemed very different from the rest or anything.
No. We had a couple of personalities. We had a religious maniac who, it was quite funny. We used to have part-time with schooling, you see, in the Navy. We had to march to the school in Douglas, and this guy, Smith he was called, we used to call him Jumbo Smith, because he must have been about 6'4" or something, tremendous size. Every time we came to a church, and we passed a few of them, he'd stop and bow to it three times, you see. We'd all pile up into him. It was quite funny. And they had all these, what did they call it? You know, like in the gear sort of thing. You'd walk very close to each other. So, you know, your legs were all... it was like supposed to be smart to do it, you see. And you were doing all this. Because so when Jumbo stopped to have a bow, you're all piled up into it. And he used to have all these icons in his... We were like in chalets. And he had all these icons there. And used to bow and mumble these religious stuff to him. to these things and that. And... they weren't very religious. In fact, they weren't religious at all, the rest of the crew, you know.
Were you
and I wasn't particularly then, once I'd moved away from home.
But you had come from
a religious background, yes. Yes, I'd read the Bible.
And was that... Do you think that was probably the case with a lot of the other lads there then? That they'd had a sort of religious upbringing of some kind, but...
No. I bet most of them didn't have a religious upbringing. Okay. Certainly it was never... Nobody appeared very religious, except, I mean, this is why people like Jumbo stood out. I mean, nobody else. He used to say his prayers and all that. Nobody else ever did. I never saw anybody else ever. No, it was... they reflected the working class. I think the working class wasn't religious. The fact that my father and mother were religious because their social life was religious. When they were younger, the church provided the social life. You know, so they were religious because it's like people joining a political party to get a social life. You know, and the church provided a social life for a lot of people. That was why they were religious. But of course, there was all sorts of other you know, social lives and so on. It was because I don't think their family were very close. There was always a lot of arguments going on, so they went their own ways. So, like, the church gave them a social life instead of the family. But a lot of the working class, the family was the social life, you know.
Did the Navy make any attempt to give religious instruction? Was there a padre?
Oh, yes, you had a padre. Yeah, and you had religion every day, sort of.
But it was just like at school, was it?
Just like a parade and prayers were said, you know.
Right, to go back to the camp itself then, you were in chalets then.
Yeah.
What did you sleep in? How many of you to a chalet?
Four to a chalet. It wasn't too bad.
Could you choose who you were in with?
No, you were allocated chalets.
Did you sleep in hammocks or just...
No, beds. Bunk beds, they were.
And so, with just four of you in a room, it must have been relatively private, really, compared to...
Yes, it wasn't too bad.
A dormitory or something.
And we had this... one of them found out that with a cocoa tin, with the wire punched through the back, fixed to the central heating pipe, you could pick up the radio. I don't know how it happened, but you could get the radio through this, you know, if you put this cocoa tin in, you could hear the programme that was on the radio. I don't know how the hell that happened. It was a peculiarity of Cunningham's holiday camp that you could get a radio through the flipping central heating, because it was centrally heated.
Would nobody have had their own radio then?
No, blimey. I mean, a radio then was a bloody big like a car battery. You had like a car battery and you had it done to that, you know, because that was the type of radios there were. If you had an electric house, if you got electricity in your house, then, you know, it'd be one of these that plugged in. But they were big things. They weren't like the portables of today. You know, they were quite big, heavy things, full of valves and all that. Where would you have kept it, you know?
So you were living in these chalets, and what about your meals? What was the food like? Were you well fed?
Yes, it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad.
How did it compare to what you were used to at home? Was it...
More variety.
Did you get more food as well?
We were never short. You had plenty of bread and... it's a three-course dinner. Yes, it wasn't bad food, as I recollect. It wasn't too bad. There was the normal rubbish, like... used to get these sausages. Of course, we had them throughout the Navy. And no matter how long you cooked them, they were tin sausages. No matter how long you cooked them, they were still a reddish colour. You know, I never tasted anything. And these terrible tin tomatoes. But, I don't know, it was all right. It was as good as what I'd been used to.
Were you homesick at all? You say you regretted joining, but were you actually homesick?
No, I wasn't homesick.
Were many people?
Oh, yes, quite a lot. A lot of people. A lot of cried and so on, you know. And
how did people react to that? Did they make fun of them?
No, not particularly.
What about the officers there? Would they pick on people who were homesick? Would they try and ridicule them?
I don't recollect. We had a petty officer that wasn't too bad. Because if you think they're all under 30, so they're all fairly young, and although they look quite old to us, I mean, they're twice our age, they were quite friendly, you know, they weren't too bad. Apart from these doing the swimming, I mean, they were seen as right swine. But although out of the swimming they were okay, you know, when you took you for PT. But... No, I thought the petty officers and that were okay. And we had some leading hands. We didn't see them.
If you were in a position where you were upset about something or worried, would there be anyone you could go to?
Oh, the padre.
Just him?
Or your divisional officer, you know. Not that I heard of anybody going.
But did anyone have a sort of formal responsibility to be responsible for welfare?
Well, your divisional officer, you know, was the...